But at certain times, I've been trying to write a history of the times that it comes on, and write it down. It's a lot of work. And it only comes on in the evening times and night times when you would need to put lights on, you know. I lived near the new arena by in Elmont, and that's new construction, maybe something over there, but no, it goes well beyond that. There was one place in Elmont Road, and I happened to be coming from the Southern State Parkway, taking the side roads back to my house, and this was something in the daytime. I think it was in the daytime, but that's a different story. I forget now. It's been a couple of years, but there was one place where for five blocks, I was listening to a radio station, AM, and I drove through this area for like five or six blocks. The noise was so intense, I couldn't hear the radio station anymore, an AM broadcast station. It was all noise until I got out of that area. It was like five blocks long. That's one thing. But at any rate, it's bewildering to me. I think the next thing I'm going to do in Little Neck, near the repeater, the Limewalk repeater, about a mile or so away, there's a FAA location where they have four towers for communication with the airlines and so on. And it's a big installation. And my next move is maybe to go over there to Little Neck and see if the noise goes that far away from me. That'll be a few more miles than I drove around. And my hope was this, that the noise would be continuing to Little Neck area. And then, if it is, maybe I can call up the FCC and say this noise is possibly interfering with the aircraft radios reception in that end over there, you know, AM. They use AM in, communication. They don't use FM. They use AM for the airlines, communication with the airlines and, you know, flight. So I'm hoping that the noise continues that far. And then I can complain to the government and say, you know, I've got a lot of noise over here that comes on at night. Maybe it's affecting communication with the planes. And then maybe the government might be interested in, seeing what I'm talking about. But at any rate, it's really, really aggravating to me. I can't operate at night what I want to do. I like to go on the air at night, AM. That's when it's nice to talk to the fellas, but I can't operate. The noise is so bad on amplitude modulation. All right. So I was hoping that maybe somebody knows somebody, like we were talking about, like 10 years ago, there was somebody who worked in the power company. I forget the circumstances of what it was all about, and you can call the guy up, and he would help us. Oh, well, life goes on. I'll have to find a different area to operate, different kind of form of transmission. 73s, by the way, I want to talk about the space.
The Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system.
I want to talk about the space.
New England reporter.
I noticed that he does a beautiful job talking about this, about the things in space and so on. And nobody calls up. He says, anybody want, I'll take a standby. Does anybody have any comments? And nobody comments to him. I feel so bad because he said, that's such a great job and it's so interesting. I actually like to listen to the Space Net. And seems that people, I'm sure there's a lot of people like me, we listen and we really enjoy hearing what he's talking about. And yet, you know, we don't have any, he does such a beautiful job doing it. Reporting about it, and yet I feel bad when nobody comments or asks them any questions. That's one of my observations. Edway?
Yeah, unfortunately, Chad, I got thrown off of All-Star when you started this transmission, so I finally got back the last 5-10 seconds. If you want to give me a little abbreviated version of what I missed, I'll listen.
I'll repeat. I particularly like to listen to the SpaceNet. It's very interesting here for me. And I feel so bad because he does such a beautiful job reporting what's going on in the area of space, rockets and so on. And it's something I look forward to listening to. Yet I never have any comments. Sometimes he says, does anybody have any comments or questions? And then nobody calls him up to ask questions. And it feels so bad, it almost sounds like, I wonder if he thinks there's nobody interested or nobody's listening. But me, I listen all the time. I wait up the best as I can to listen to the SpaceNet. And I sometimes feel terrible that nobody seems to ask him any questions. So I just want to let him know that he's doing a great job. And while maybe he's doing such a thorough job with the SpaceNet and describing things that we have no questions to ask him or comments. So I want to let him know that I appreciate it, and I'm sure other people are listening. And the SpaceNet that he reports on is a very good thing for people like me to listen to. Over.
Okay, very good, Chet. Yeah, I certainly appreciate Paul. He's doing an excellent job. He's done it for years upon years upon years upon years. And I'm getting some kind of echo in the system now, unfortunately. Anyway, sometimes it's difficult to elicit questions. People just kind of get into this mode where they're watching the show and they're just sitting there listening. We have a few participants out there who are kind of regular people who kind of break into Paul's SpaceNet report and ask him about things. It could be more, but that's the nature of things. When I used to do the
Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
Well, let's see if I can get across. Anyway, when I was doing the tech segment, and I would talk about different subjects, some would elicit a great deal of response, and others, no response. And you never know quite what's going to tick people on. I did a story that included mitochondrial DNA, and we were basically talking about the subject for 45 minutes, and I would have never guessed that. So I hope that Paul appreciates the fact that we all appreciate him, and, just because a lot of people don't ask a lot of questions, some people are concerned that they might sound that they're not too brilliant on the subject. I never quite understood that. I mean, the way of wisdom is to ask a lot of questions. But, it's some people's introverted nature, and that's the way it unfortunately is. You got to deal with things like that. The number of people who listen to Nets, it far outnumbers the people who participate and talk on them. It's just the way it is.
Comment?
Sure.
Yeah, I just want to piggyback on what the other station said there. Always enjoy listening to Paul and appreciate, everything that he puts out there.
Thank you, John. I'm sure Paul appreciates it. Anyway, this is AC2GS. We're coming up to the close of this segment, this portion of the technical net. But in case anyone has any comments or questions or topics that they want to make, if they're relatively short, feel free, hit that push to talk. Okay. I guess everyone's talked out as far as amateur radio and technology. Paul, WS2N, I guess it's time for the SpaceNet report.
Okay, a little early, but very good for you. And the guys are making comments. We've been doing the SpaceNet for like ever. I mean, I keep track of money, and I think I'm up to 692 or something since I started keeping track. Before that, you know, we just got on and did KYW. He loved the space program, and he'd bring up different topics, and I said, oh, this is great. He kept asking question after question, and one thing led to another, so eventually we started the year, started on a regular basis. So, I always stand by and see if anybody has any comments, because, you know, ham radios, you're really not supposed to be on there broadcasting. It's not a broadcasting like what Roy always says. You need to have, you know, somebody come back, but what's wrong with asking? And then when nobody comes back, well, then we just keep on going. So that's what we do. Let me drop it. And, I started off as a kid watching the space programs, like a lot of you guys. The years went by, and, you know, life gets in the way here and there, and eventually, you know, I picked up ham radio, but I always paid attention to what was going on with the space program, and I just never left that world. And we accumulated a lot of interest in all the different programs over the years, and we talk about some of the movies that are coming out. There's one coming out this week. I think it's in a week or so. I haven't checked the date. It's called Project Hail Mary. You know, so cover the books, and it was a book, and now it's a movie. And it's supposed to be very good from what I've heard. And we'll watch that. And it's made by the same author that made the Andy Weir. He's made a couple of books. I thought this other book was going to make it as a movie, but that didn't make it as a movie. But this one did. So, looking forward to it. Very good science fiction story. Let me just drop it. And we always try to keep up with current events of what's going on in the space program. But years ago, when Dick was on, he was interested in the past, you know, how things got to be the way they are, you know, all the different old programs, you know, going through, Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo, and eventually Apollo Soyuz and Skylab, and, you know, all the way to Shuttle and Space Station. But one thing led to another. We started talking about the current events more often, so I try to keep up with, you know, what's happening. And one particular flight that's going to be going up very shortly, April 1st, a couple of weeks. That's the planned date, anyway. Will be Artemis 2. I know I've talked about it many times here on the net, and you actually hear this one quite a bit on, well, if you hear space topic in the next week or two, they're probably going to be talking about Artemis 2. And that's the one that will be flying to the moon, but not landing on the moon. It'll be flying with four astronauts. Not like the old days when you had Apollo and they'd fly with three. This is four. Much bigger volume-wise inside the Orion spacecraft. And you have three guys and one woman. The three guys actually have an AM license. All are American call signs because they got their ticket in Texas, including the one guy is Canada. Hanson, his last name is. He has an American call sign as well. The only one that doesn't have it is Christina Cook. She's been an astronaut for many years. She has the record for the longest time at one time for a woman in space, just short of a year. National Space Station. But they chose her as one of the four. Grover, Finn, and Reed. They'll be looking to see what the other side of the moon looks like. Actually, they're going to pass the moon, go past around 4,000 or 5,000 miles, and then they'll start being pulled back. They're not going to go into orbit around the moon. So it's a free return. They'll be going in, you know, when they get near the moon, they'll be going into the front of the moon, you know, when I say the front, in the direction of travel. And then that'll create a figure eight, you know, from Earth around the moon and back. And this way, if there's something wrong with the Ohms engine, the one engine that they do have on the service module, which is designed to put them into orbit and also take them out of orbit, last thing they need is to go into orbit and not be able to get out of orbit. So they want to be able to fire this engine a number of times during the flight. So they will use the engine, but they just won't use it to put themselves into orbit or out of orbit. So turns out this whole trip will take 9 days. Months ago it was 10. They've shortened it now to 10, to 9 days. Then they'll do this free recall and then re-enter the atmosphere 25,000 miles per hour. Really test out the heat shield again. Last time on Apollo 1, almost 3 years ago, that was an uncrewed flight. They were not happy about the heat shield, the way it looked. Little pieces broke off here and there that they didn't expect. Now, to mitigate that, this time they plan on entering the atmosphere at a slightly different angle, where they could more or less skip along the atmosphere. You know, they'll rise up into space a little bit, come back down again, rise up again a little bit more, and come back down again. This way, the high temperatures, which, you know, when you come back at 25,000 miles an hour, your temperatures on the heat shield get up 5,000 degrees. They want to keep that a little on the low side, and by changing the way they enter into the atmosphere, they feel they'll have no problem. And they'll still land in the Pacific Ocean, and they'll be picked up there. Any comments? WS2S. Now, future flights to the moon, they've changed the whole system of what they were going to have. You know, Artemis 3 is planned, of course, next. And Artemis 3, for years, they said, oh, that was the one that was going to actually land on the moon. Their plans of sending it out, orbiting the moon, having it dock with SpaceX Starship, 171-foot-long thing, and then that was going to come down and land vertically on the moon with two of the four astronauts. and the other two would stay in orbit on Orion. As time went by, and they'd spend maybe a week on the surface, they would fly back up, dock with Orion. All four would come back and land in the Pacific. That has now all been changed. They have a new administrator, Jared Isaacman. You know, I believe I covered this all last week, but going over it one more time. He said, well, we have to make some changes here. We don't want this, just these 3 year, or 2 or 3 year delays between flights. A number of things happen when you do that. One of the things is that, you know, all the people that work on these programs, sometimes they want to go off and do something else. They don't see another flight coming, you know, for years. So they plan on having more often, you know, Artemis 3, 4, 5, that type of thing. That's one of the reasons. The Artemis 3 mission now, instead of going to land on the moon, they plan on putting it into orbit around the Earth, and then having it dock with the landing vehicle. They want to make sure this whole docking thing works out before they send it to the moon and have them dock going around the moon. They want to see if it all works. So they're going to simulate moon orbit by being in Earth orbit and actually have them dock with the Starship here around Earth. A heck of a lot safer. And it's a good idea. It's duplicating a system that Apollo 9 did years ago. That was the plan from the beginning with the Apollo system. You know, Apollo went up. Apollo 7, well, that was the first manned Apollo mission. That just orbited the Earth. Let's just check out the command module. That's what they did. And Apollo 8, they said, okay, we're going to send that to the moon, which they did. It orbited the moon, you know, actually 10 orbits, and then returned to the Earth safely. And then Apollo 9, they wanted to check out the LEM, lunar module, before they actually sent it to the moon. So they put, you know, they wanted both vehicles in orbit around Earth, which they did. And, you know, with the Apollo system, they launched the two vehicles together. You know, they would be in orbit. The Apollo 9 would pull out, grab a hold of the LEM. The crew would transfer. And then they actually separated in Earth orbit, and they would go a couple hundred miles away from one another, and then eventually return, and then dock, and made sure that all worked before they even thought about sending this whole system to the moon. And that's what they plan on doing now with Artemis 3. Instead of landing on the moon, put it into Earth orbit along with the HLS. HLS is the Human Landing System, which will be one of two vehicles. It'll either be the Starship that I talked about before, this 171-foot long thing, SpaceX, and they'll dock with that and make sure that, you know, everything works in Earth orbit. NASA, in this case, has a Plan B. Which, you know, years ago, when this whole thing was being planned, they only gave the contract to SpaceX, which, in my opinion, was a big mistake. They needed to give it to another company as well. In case one company doesn't work out, the other company will. It's a long-standing tradition with NASA. Always have redundancy. Send out two vehicles. One fails, the other one will be okay. And if both are good, then we have two good vehicles. We should have two. And years ago with the Pioneers spacecraft, and they were the first two that went beyond Earth orbit. Into the stars, Pioneer 10 and Pioneer 11, you know, will never come back to Earth, but they are on the way, you know, out of the solar system. And then eventually they did that with Voyager. So when they had enough money, this is what they would do. So you had Voyager 1, Voyager 2, which if one failed, well, we got the other one. It turns out both of them were good. And they still are operating. Those two are still operating today. The redundancy system made a comeback. NASA years ago said, okay, you know, SpaceX can't do it. We'll take the plan B. The plan B was Blue Origin. Their plan was to create another lunar lander. They call it Blue Moon, and it's called Blue Moon Mark II. Mark I is a smaller version of the human lander. You know, Mark I is a cargo vehicle, which they plan on landing on the lunar surface in the not too distant future. Which is an important flight, by the way, because they're going to test the engines that they plan on using for the actual lunar lander. So there's a difference between the two landers. Starship is this 170-foot thing that SpaceX is putting out, 12-foot diameter rocket that will land in one piece. Take off from the moon. That will be the human landing system, and then the part B is Blue Origin Blue Moon vehicle. That's not 170 feet. It's a lot shorter. It's about twice the height of the original LEM. Remember the LEM sitting on the surface of the moon, roughly 25 feet high. This thing's like 53 feet high. So it's roughly twice the size of the LEM, and also designed to carry four people to the surface, where the LEM was designed to carry two. So it's a much bigger vehicle. They plan, both of them plan on doing two things. When Orion gets to lunar orbit, and you have these four people in orbit, two people will stay on board Orion, and the other two people will get on the human landing system. It will either be Blue Origin's Blue Moon or SpaceX Starship. They don't know which one is going to win out. They thought for years it was going to be Starship, but he's now way behind in his... Anyway, Starship will be ready to be the lander that will land on the moon. They plan on that being the first, and then after that, they eventually plan on using Blue Origin's Mark II Blue Moon vehicle. Like I said before, they meaning SpaceX, is behind schedule. They've launched 11 of these Starships so far and still have not made it to orbit. And that's a little concerning. So I'm glad they have redundancy. The Blue Moon vehicle. Now, that vehicle hasn't even been launched from Earth yet. So, you know, you got that are pushing to be the one now that will land on the moon first. And both of them are, you know, are somewhat behind schedule. SpaceX more so because there's nothing that's been delayed with Blue Origin. They're still on target, and we'll see within about a couple of months if they can get their first vehicle to actually land on the moon, and that would be the cargo version of the human landing system. We'll see. Now, what has creeped up is there's dangers in these vehicles, especially SpaceX. SpaceX has been landing vertically with this 170-foot-long vehicle. It's like a, you know what, you know, 15-story building. The crew is low near the top of the rocket, like most rockets. They need to get down to the surface. They have a plan. I've seen, you know, I've seen the drawings. You can find them on the internet, you know, the information of an elevator system. You know, they'll open up the door, you know, 15-story surface of the moon. The two people will get onto this platform, and they'll have cables, and it will be put to the surface. You know, have a mechanism to do that. So it's essentially an elevator on the outside of the vehicle, and, which is fine. And it'll, you know, get down to the bottom, go out, do their science and research, pick up their rocks, whatever they're going to do. Now it's time to come back. They have to hope that this elevator system works. Two people now have to get all the way back up. You know, if something goes wrong, there's a plan B on that. Like I said, they like redundancy. So NASA is pushing for, you know, some kind of redundancy system, which I haven't heard one idea yet of how they would do it without the elevator. So we'll see. That's one of the turns now. Blue Origin doesn't have that problem. They're going to have a ladder, you know, similar to what the six lems that landed on the moon have. You know, they'd get out, walk down the ladder, get onto the moon, walk back up. Because the new Blue Moon vehicle, you know, is, yeah, sure, it's twice as big, but, you know, it still will have a ladder. So, yeah, it's going to be a longer ladder, but so that, you know, that's doable. They won't have that that concern. They don't need a plan B on getting back into their spacecraft to return back to Earth. So that's one of the main concerns. Another concern is, see, you know, they're going to have a wide dance on Blue Moon, similar to the LEM. LEM had, if you measure from one pad to the other pad, you know, they had four legs. It was something like 33 feet. The Blue Moon is going to be a lot bigger. So, you know, you know the physics of it, it's a lot better to make sure that when they land, you know, they're not going to tip over. Where you land 170-foot diameter thing onto the moon, a couple of things you know, you have to be concerned of. You know, first of all, the exhaust, you know, when you come down, it's going to be blowing into the surface of the moon. You know, that could. They do have a plan B with that. They're going to have side thrusters coming out. So, you know, maybe halfway up the vehicle, the thrusters will come on, and they could eliminate the problem of disturbing the surface when they actually land. and for that matter, when they take off, but you could still win. You know, there's craters all over, hills, and, you know, you could wind up landing in such a fashion where it's not vertical, where you're on a tilt, and they are worried about this thing falling over. SpaceX has two problems to, make sure that things don't go wrong. Will this Starship fall over after it lands? And also, will the crew be able to get back up? Also, you could have a crew going up and down on this elevator. You can get halfway up, and the elevator, the system could break. Now what do you do? It's 1/6 gravity, but, you still want to jump off a vehicle to get down to the ground. And then once you're on the ground, again, how do you get back up? So, will it work not only for the crew to get back up, will it also work going up and down, or is it going to get stuck midway? They have to, SpaceX has to answer to NASA, for that kind of a problem. Any questions? WS2N. Okay, nothing heard. I try to leave enough time for Echo Link. I don't know if I did, though. Let me drop it. Okay, this is WS2N for the Space Now report. Another mission I'm interested in. It's still a couple of years away. They call it Dragonfly. The Dragonfly rotorcraft that NASA has been building for quite a few years. The idea of this vehicle is to fly all the way to one of the moons of Saturn, which is going to be Titan. Of course, you're not going to have a crew, but they do want to investigate that moon. So it's been on their to-do list for many, many years. It's the size of a car. It's roughly about, 12 feet by 12 feet, something like that. And it has all these rotors, these long rotors. Each rotor looks like they're probably about 4 feet long. And this is going to be like, fly like a drone. You have four different spots around the vehicle with these blades spinning. One's going to be going clockwise, the other one counterclockwise. So there'll be a total of eight blades spinning. The idea is to fly this thing all the way to Saturn. They plan on launching it on a SpaceX heavy vehicle, which is taking a Falcon 9, put three of them together, both of them together, and you're going to get, over 5 million pounds of thrust to push this thing all the way to Saturn. When it gets near Saturn, which is going to take many years, they're looking at 2034. It's going to take roughly 6 years to fly from Earth all the way to the orbit of Saturn. So, it'll fly into the atmosphere of Titan, which is a very thick atmosphere. It's a nitrogen atmosphere. A couple of bar atmosphere, much more high pressure than what we have on Earth, which is good for having something fly. So it looks like they're going to have this vehicle come down with parachutes and then eventually heat shield, and then the heat shield will eventually separate as it's getting closer and closer to the surface of Titan. The you know, the old system that they use for landing capacity and perseverance on Mars, you know, what they had was the vehicle would, at that point, start separating, you know, being lowered on cables, you know, from the descent module. And then eventually, when it got near to the surface, they had these power taxes, the technical devices, create like a clean cutters, and it would separate the vehicle, and it would be on the surface of Mars. Here, they'll be coming down to the surface. Instead of this cable system, they'll actually let it separate, you know, fly right off the descent module. And as it's coming down to the surface, these rotators will start spinning. Will actually start flying right away. And then it will search for a safe landing place, all kinds of cameras, of course, on board, and laser finders, and, you know, all that good stuff. And then it will find a location and land on the moon Titan, where, at that point, it will be kind of like the Curiosity and Perseverance rover. It will have, you know, broke arms that will come out, it will dig into the surface. It will have chemistry lab on board, analyze stuff. After it does its thing, for who knows how long, and they're happy, you know, investigating that particular location, Dragonfly will spin up its rotators somewhere else. And it looks like it could fly maybe every time it takes a flight, maybe it'll go 5 miles away from where they're located. That's what I've read, have that capability. Very thick atmosphere will make it very easy to fly. You know, you won't have the rotators spinning at a ridiculous speed. That's what they had with the helicopter that they flew on Mars. The helicopter was called Ingenuity, and it was only maybe as big as a tissue box, but it had these big long rotators on top, and they were hoping to get 5 flights out of that thing. Well, they got 72 flights out of Ingenuity, and the difference is that was solar powered. It was separate from the main vehicle, Perseverance, that brought it there. But it would communicate back and forth to Perseverance. On Dragonfly, it's all in one, one piece. You're just going to have this whole vehicle flying from location to location, which really sounds like, you know, something out of science fiction, but this is what they have plans of doing. They're financed right now. They're testing over in Johns Hopkins University over in Maryland, testing different parts of this, because they're going to eventually integrate a power source. It's not going to be solar powered. You know, you can't get that at Saturn. So it's going to be flying with an RTG to power it. You know, it's going to be a nuke. You know, RTGs are radioisotope thermoelectric generators. So that's what they're going to use. It'll be recharging batteries. It's ready. Go off. Go somewhere else. And then use that power also to operate the arms. It won't have wheels. No reason to drive around. Wherever it lands, it'll do its thing. And who knows how many flights they'll get out of it. Will they get 72 flights like Ingenuity? Who knows? But that's the update on Dragonfly. We'll see if this all works in the early 2030s. Any comments, put in that WS2N.
From a purely practical standpoint, One of these thermoelectric generators, how many of those things would it take to power your typical, I don't know, go-kart or small car from New York to Philadelphia on a perfectly flat trajectory, like no hills, no stops, no nothing?
New York to Philadelphia? No, 100. What's the power you get out of the, out of one RTG? Voyager, when they left, they had like three of them. So yeah, let's say you could develop one of these things. Now, by the way, you know, it's very hard to get the material. There's only a certain amount that our government has. So, you know, they really use this stuff sparingly. Over the years, I think there's probably been, you know, maybe 16 flights over the decades that have used this stuff. So let's say, you want to do it, and you're a billionaire. You pay the government. I want it up plutonium 238. To put into this RTG to power my batteries, so I could drive, from let's say from Boston to New York. You build your vehicle, you would have batteries similar to what you have on Curiosity and Perseverance, so lithium ion batteries. I believe they have 2 40-amp-hour batteries. So what happens is, during the downtime when those vehicles are not doing anything, they're just like sitting on the surface, mostly at night, they're not crazy about driving the vehicles around at night. The RTGs are charging these 40-amp-hour batteries. What's planned, if we're here on Earth, you're going to get from Boston. We're a couple hundred units per day, let's say. On Mars, that's what they do. I think the record is almost 300 feet they went one time, when it was like nothing in the way. They just, put the pedal to the metal and, over Martian Day, which is roughly the same as today. Maybe they were able to, get a couple hundred feet. So, you will build this thing on Earth, and then it's going to take, but eventually you're going to get from, let's say, Boston to New York, or whatever two cities you recommended. You'll get there sooner or later. Remember now, Curiosity was landed on Mars what was it? Oh, my goodness. I have this memorized for that. I believe it's 2012. And it's still operating all these years later. Here we are in 2026, and Curiosity is still driving. And Perseverance, of course, was the second vehicle with an RTG on it as well. And that landed 2020, and again, that's still going. Here we are. I think that was February, so it landed 2020. Here we are 6 years later, and Perseverance is still doing good. And they rack up average on their wattometer. And theoretically, you could actually do it. Back over to you. I forgot to call. WS2N.
WS2N AC2PL. Alpha Charlie 2 Papa Lima. It's Jeff. Anyway, I'm asking smart-ass questions, excuse the language, simply because that's the sort of thing that they do when, you walk into a room and you say, oh, we're going to do this, and they say, what is possible, and ask you to put it up on the blackboard and calculate exactly how it's going to work. And that's what they with all due respect to everyone on the net, that's what they ask you to do on your candidacy to PhD. And after you've done all your research, when you think you have your PhD, that's what they ask you to do again. How's this going to work? How's it going to play out? Is this going to work? You know, play along with my little scenario. And man, you deserve a PhD more times over than I could even imagine. So, honorary PhD to you tonight, sir, from whatever institute you might choose. Thank you very much, Paul, for playing along. AC2PL.
Okay, Jeff, thank you very much. And I'll get a PhD from the Institute of Weimar, I guess, whatever. Yeah, for sure. And the deal is, of course, with radioactive things. They've tested them over the decades. Sure, they don't. They won't break apart, you know, in case the rocket goes up and it's crashing down. You know, is it going to contaminate the area? They have blown these things up. They've crashed them into the RTG, you know, without the, you know, without the plutonium inside. They've actually done everything they could possibly do to destroy these things, and they would not fly unless they were safe. I remember when Cassini went up, that had one of these things in it as well, RTG. So, and what RTG is, you know, you take the uranium-238 and you put it inside of a blanket. You know, like it's really like a graphite blanket, so that the heat that comes off of these things, you know, it has a hard time going anywhere. It tries to stay within the blanket. Within the blanket, you have all these thermocouples. You know, they're all linked together. They're hooked together in parallel. Hooked together in series until they get the voltage that they want. It's always 28 volts that they always want. So they have enough to put them in series to get the 28 volts and then parallel to get as many amps out of it as possible until they get a complete unit. And then these things tick along for many years. Look at Voyager, still operating. Went up in there, 1977. Amazing. Let me drop it. So, you know, it's a wonderful thing. The two rovers that they had before that was Opportunity and Spirit, and they were solar panels. And they, even though those things work great, I mean, Spirit worked for 6 years. Opportunity worked for 14 years. And these things, you know, the RTGs, they're going to, you know, they'll run them until they won't run anymore, you know, until wheels fall off, I guess. The same thing will hold true with Dragonfly. Okay.
Complete.
Yeah, just one other comment. Cygnus left the International Space Station. Cygnus is a cargo vehicle. It's been attached since September. And that thing has flown 23 times in different sizes. Years ago, it was a lot shorter. They made it bigger over the years. They called the Cygnus XL. and successfully bought 11,000 pounds worth of, you know, everything, science equipment, to clothes, to food, you know, water, pressurized tanks, to the International Space Station back in September. And now it was time to leave. So when it leaves, all the junk, things are thrown away. And then the next move for Cygnus, within probably a week or so, will be to deorbit over the South Pacific, burn up in the atmosphere, you know, 100%, whatever survives will wind up in the South Pacific. And years ago, actually about 4 or 5 years ago, they used to take the Cygnus vehicles and they used to test them before, you know, they put science experiments inside, and they'd operate it for, you know, months at a time before they would deorbit it. They used to light fires inside of them, you know, they'd ignite them, and they'd have cameras and telemetry sent back, and Cygnus would, you know, do that job for them. Quite a few flights, and eventually I guess they got enough data that they don't do that anymore. But, you know, they serve a good purpose. The Cygnus that went up launched on, you know, launch on any kind of vehicle. They launched on the Atlas V, and they also launched on the SpaceX Falcon 9. But in a short, I think within another year, maybe year and a half, they'll be launching again on the Antares rocket, which launches out of Virginia. They, you know, for years they used to launch on Antares, but eventually they wanted to change out their rocket engines, and they wanted to build a bigger rocket, and which they're almost ready to do. So we'll, in the near future, we'll see future Cygnus spacecraft launched from Wallops Island, Virginia, on the new Antares rocket that's being developed by Northrop Grumman. Well, I'm looking at the time. With that, let me take a minute to ID, and then we're going to be turning it back over to Roy. Yeah, it's WS2N for the Space Force for the TechNet, and we'll be back here hopefully next week. And tomorrow's Monday. That's when Mark has the Club Info Net. You don't have to be a member to check in. Just say hello. Everybody's welcome. And the same holds true with the swap at George 82 FIU. They'll be doing that. And that's always followed by Radio Newsline. Very informative, of course. Yeah, you can get it online, but I like listening to it over the air that Weimar puts out. With that, let me turn it over to you, Roy, AC2GS. This is WS2N for the SpaceNet report. For the TechNet, back to you, Roy.
AC2GS, thank you, Paul. Thank you for the SpaceNet report. Thank you for all that you do on the technical net, and thank you for all you do for the club. We all appreciate it. And I appreciate everyone's participation tonight, and I hope you learned something, and I hope you'll return next week when we try and do this all over again. As per usual, let me remind you of some words of wisdom from some clever people, one being our own Dick K2RIW. He would end most of his technical nets with the advice to be kind to each other, and that's always good advice. And good old Epictetus, it's impossible for a man to learn what he thinks he already knows. So, as I've often said, keep your mind open to new ideas, but not so wide open that your brain falls out. Hey, you're going to need it one of these days. Everyone, have a great week. Stay safe. Be well. And if you can, please try to join us again next Sunday night at 8 o'clock when we do this all over again. This is AC2GS formally closing this episode of the Limark Technical Net. After I say, Slava Ukraine.